With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome along to this week's Writer's Routine, where we take a sneak peek inside the working day of some of the most successful authors around. This week, we're chatting to Owen Nichols. His debut novel, Love Unscripted, is out right now. It's a rom-com that taps into the deep, kind of obsessed love of pop culture that so many of us share. He refers to it as high fidelity about films, so it gives you an idea of the journey the story's going to take. Now, he's written as a journalist for film magazines for ages, so we'll talk about how he transferred that style of writing into working on novels. Also, we'll hear about the difference between writing for novels and screenplays, and how sometimes he has to listen to that voice inside his head and start thinking about the reader again.
I can see it in my head. I just kind of... even with my novels, it's kind of quite a filmic visualization process, so I can see it, and sometimes I need to stop and go, wait a second, the reader doesn't know where we are, and maybe you can give them a bit more description of who they're seeing. It goes back to the voice that just comes out of nowhere. It just tells me what the next word is.
So that's all on the way with this week's Writer's Routine, and it's Owen Nichols. Yes, welcome along to this week's Writer's Routine, where we have a look at how creative people get stuff done and plan their day. My name's Dan Simpson. Thank you so much for finding us and giving us a listen. Before we get cracking with the episode, I want to massively thank you for all the reaction to our last episode with the writer of Everybody's Talking About Jamie, the West End musical, Tom McRae. I've had such an outpouring of some amazing reactions to that. He really kind of found it, didn't he? He got the whole thing. He tapped into exactly what we need to know from a writer about how they get stuff done, how they work. And he's just finished rapping, actually. I saw online the other day that he had finished making the movie of Everybody's Talking About Jamie. He's flown back to LA now. Oh, look how the other half live. I'm so jealous. So Tom, if you're listening, thank you so much for coming over here. I cannot wait to see the Jamie movie, and I'd really appreciate you sharing some words about how you work through your day with us. We got so much incredible advice from that one. He just got it, didn't he? And Owen does too. This week's guest, Owen Nichols, he completely gets it. I think it's because he's studied art forms, particularly films, for so long. He's really good at breaking down the process. We talk about his debut, Love Unscripted, how he finally wrote the novel, what he learned about it from journalism, and how much pop culture affected it and made him think about the way to write a relatable lead character. And when you are so obsessed with films, when you're such a cinephile, how that plays into the way you structure your scenes when you're writing a novel. Now, there is quite a lot of... There is a little bit of, I should say, rambling film chat. Normally, I'll be honest, I would cut quite a lot of it out in the edit. I just think it's quite necessary to keep some of it in this one, because Owen's story is so centred around films as a way of showing emotion. So I've kept it in. I hope you find some of our thoughts kind of worthwhile. We dive into it, as always, with Owen Nichols, starting with what he sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
I see a corkboard. I see a very weird picture of Lord Byron that my friend bought me as a wedding present. I think he literally was like on the way to the wedding and he was just going, I've got no connection to Lord Byron. But I did do a bit of research after he gave me the present and that was an interesting guy. Somebody should make a film about him. So there's a corkboard with kind of the plot for the next novel kind of vaguely mapped out. I've got some pictures of... I would say so. There's a band and a picture of a comedy duo.
Who's the band? Who's the duo?
So the band is Frightened Rabbit.
Okay.
And the comedy duo, the main, well, not the main woman, but the reason why the comedy duo up there is Charlie Clive. She was in Pure. Did you see that, the Channel 4 show?
I did not.
But I have this thing now where I really like to have in my head, like, and on the board in front of me, what that person looks like. So I'm writing with these kind of people front and center.
Talk to me about the rest of the room if you can. So you've got the corkboard directly in front of you. Where is the room? Is it in your house? Have you got an annex? Have you got a shed? What color are the walls apart from Lord Byron? Is there anything else to capture the imagination?
So I wish I had a shed. I've been talking about a shed for a very long time, but no, I live in a two-bed house, and because I've got two kids, they have their room. We have our room, and then the office has to be the bedroom as well. So I've got this massive desk, which is far too big for the room, right in the corner, next to the window, so I can see out. That's quite nice. And then on the desk is the laptop, loads of books kind of spilled around, and then, yeah, the corkboard in front of that.
You're in the bedroom?
In the bedroom, yeah. Yeah, and then my wife, I almost said partner, but we got married 2 months ago, so I've got to get that right. Wife, she sits in the other corner because she's a graphic designer and she works from home as well. So our bedroom is a multi-person office.
Now, you got married 2 months ago.
Yep.
Working with your wife in the same room every day.
Yep.
Without wanting to, you know, hoist tension upon you. How is that going?
Well, we met at work, so we met in a cinema. We didn't get together, it was kind of a few years later, but after that we also worked together when we lived in Toronto, and we also worked together at the previous job. I was working for a challenger bank as a copywriter, and we worked literally next to each other there as well. So we do very well together, actually. Surprisingly, a lot of people are kind of like, I would kill my partner if I saw them that much, but we're not there yet.
You mentioned earlier on, if I were to look at your corkboard, I would see plotting for your next novel. What form does that plotting take? Would it be clear to me, a randomer, a stranger that just walks into your room, or is it just scattergun post-it notes that are really just useful for you?
It's very shorthand, so yeah, I don't think it'd make a whole lot of sense to any kind of person just walking in. But also I'd be like, why have you walked into my bedroom? This is weird. So, yeah, it's very
much...
I came
here for work. This is where everyone works.
Yeah. At the Norfolk Hub. So, yeah, we've got all the... basically kind of the main outline so that I know kind of at what stage I'm at. So right at the moment, I'm halfway through, but I like to know exactly where I'm going to end up. So all that's kind of up on the board. And then I can kind of like tick it off as I go. But I'm quite almost mathematical with my plotting. I'm like, right, the first book was, I think, 45 chapters. And I think I decided some arbitrary number, I'm going to have 50. And I'll kind of plot it out that way. And then this one is set over 5 years. So it's kind of like 10 chapters is 1 year. And it's kind of, it's broken down that kind of strictly. But it seems to work.
Without getting too niche, I get asked by listeners to this quite a lot about specific software that you're using. I know. Are you just Word? Are you Pages? What's going on? How are you writing?
So this shocks people as well. I write on a Chromebook. It cost me £90 from John Lewis in the sale. It doesn't have Word in a kind of like you can save stuff. So I basically write everything on the cloud, which people are like, just baffled by. But in previous lives I've had laptops and I've lost so much work, but now it's like it's always there. I still email it to myself just every now and again just to make sure it's kind of somewhere else as well, But I find it just works. It's like the cheapest way of writing a novel, but yeah, I don't have to buy software, I don't have to do updates.
I find that makes perfect sense. Like I understand why people might be shocked, but I mean, if you think, they probably know everything anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. The cloud knows everything anyway,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
So at least it's existing, not on something that I could break because I'm ridiculously clumsy.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, the show is called Writer's Routine. Owen, talk me through yours. The moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed on a day when you are sitting down to write, how does it look? Talk me through the whole thing.
Okay, so I have two young children, a five-year-old and a three-year-old. So that's how I get woken up every day. Usually at 6:30. They have one of these like grow clocks where you can kind of set it so that it's blue at night and then basically the sun comes up on the clock. So we tell them, don't come through until the sun comes up. And they're very good at that. So they come through at 6:30 every day. Then it'll be downstairs, breakfast all together. The eldest is in school, so he'll kind of get ready for school. If the youngest is in nursery that day, he'll get ready. And then, so it's really very much like an office job, as in 9 o'clock, I will be at my desk. That varies a little bit because I like to run. So one of the best ways to start the day for me, I think, is just to go for a 5 or 10K run. And usually I'll kind of come back with like a head full of ideas that I can kind of splurge onto the page. So once the kind of initial scribbling of what I'm going to do that day is down on paper, it will be a case of typing up. So I used to write a lot freehand, but now I'll go straight to just typing away. I can usually do a good sprint in the morning from about 10 till about 12. Really like to have lunch kind of dead on 12. Usually we'll have a full hour as well, and it's kind of, that can kind of creep to an hour and a half some days. It's like, oh, don't really want to go back up there, but I will. And then I tried to actually like write down hour by hour what I would do, like day by day, but that never really worked because I like to work on kind of multiple projects at once. So while the second novel is kind of the main bulk of my work, I'm also working on a couple of features and a couple of TV shows. So I need to kind of make sure I've got days. So a lot of the time, morning can be novel and then afternoon can be screenplays.
And you're writing till about 5 o'clock?
Yeah, usually. So me and my wife kind of share the pickup. So sometimes I'll pick up the boys about 3:30. So that can be a short day. But that's not so bad some days. Other days it's kind of like, oh God, the day's like disappeared so quickly. Like you think, because when you have very young children, they're around all the time and you've got no free time. And then they go to school and you're like, oh, that's like 6 hours every day that I've just got back out of nowhere. But those 6 hours can absolutely disappear. But sometimes that's kind of okay. If I am just like, oh, I've got an idea for something, but I don't know what it is yet, that can just be me sat in a chair, freehand, kind of, well, this might work and this is a bit like this show, so how does this show do it, that kind of thing. With a novel, it's not quite as prescriptive, I suppose, so it'll be a lot more, it'll just flow. But with a screenplay, it's very particular. Kind of, you, one of the best tips that you get for writing a screenplay is get into a scene and out of a scene as quickly as possible. So you need to know exactly what you want that scene to do. Whereas with a novel, I can kind of really kind of enjoy kind of being in that scene for as long as I want, and then I can edit it down. But I always try with the screenplay to be as precise as I can.
You mentioned editing it down then and taking your time with a novel. One of the tips that we often hear most on the show is the importance of just getting your dirty draft down, just getting those words on the page. How are you with that technique? Are you just splurging any stream of consciousness that you can, or are you trying to make sure that each word is the best that it can be so you don't have to work too hard later?
I'm a bit more kind of splurge, but I don't write like, some days it can just be a couple of thousand words, that'll be the most I can do. So it's not so much kind of write down anything, but it's also not like pernickety. It's somewhere in the middle. It's kind of, it's not everything has to be perfect now. And I'm not one of these kind of like the next day I've written a chapter and I'll go back to that chapter and kind of like, I don't know, go crazy trying to make it perfect. It'll just be like, right, that is what it is, and kind of let's move on to the next one.
And you've also said how thorough and mathematical a planner and a plotter that you are. If I were to look at a scene plan for your next chapter, one of the 50, what form does it take? What would it look like? What would I see on the page? How do you know what you're going to be writing day to day, I guess, is the question.
Well, with this current novel, it's alternating between the two characters. So I've mapped out exactly where their journeys are, and it's kind of a case of sort of getting into that headspace of whichever character. And it's quite a lot of fun, because some days I'll be like, I don't really want to write Tom, I want to write Jess, or I don't really want to write Jess, I want to write Tom. And that's kind of wonderful to kind of make sure that you're not stuck for too long. And I can also jump from, say, I'm on chapter 26 at the moment. I've had a nice idea for the ending, so I'll happily go and write a bit of that and then jump back to the other bit if that bit's not quite working as well.
So I'm not sure how this would work with another metaphor that we always get on the show, which is about a story and you're plotting as a roadmap. You know, and you know where you're starting. You know where you're ending, maybe. And it's how much of your journey are you aware of, or are you happy to go on this magical mystery tour? When you're plotting and you're getting in the car about to set off, what do you know about the journey?
So right at the start, very, very little. I'll have my characters first. That's always been the way that I've kind of written. And then that's sort of, sounds a little bit wanky. Can I say wanky?
Yeah.
I can't say wanky. But they will sort of guide me. Like I'll know who they are before I know what they're going to do. And the more I write, the more they kind of present themselves to me, I suppose.
Also, just lastly on the day, you spoke about running. The joys of running early on in the morning, and you find that you come back, you know, brimming with ideas. Do they come completely out of nowhere while you're on your 5-10K, or do you kind of have some problems that you know need to be ironed out whilst you're on this run?
When it's kind of flowing like it is at the moment, I know what the next chapter is going to be. So I'll kind of say, I'll be right, I know that he's at an interview, or she's kind of about to meet a friend that she hasn't seen in a while. And because that's my starting point, that can just kind of percolate and go. But I'm sure you and your listeners will have come across the Elizabeth Gilbert TED Talk, where she talks about genius and just the idea that of muses and kind of where ideas come from. And she has this wonderful story about Tom Waits in his car. He's driving along and all of a sudden a song comes to him, and he's kind of like, can't you see that I'm driving now? I can't go bother Tom Petty or somebody. I just can't be dealing with this right now. And that is exactly how I kind of feel when ideas come. It's like, it's just a voice or something that kind of, I don't know where it comes from. I can't capture it. It just comes. So it might come out on a run. It might come literally while I'm in the middle of a flow. But yeah, I no idea where that comes from, and I don't know.
How do you try and make it come more readily and more frequently? Have you any methods and techniques that you use?
I don't think you can. I think it's, well, I don't think I can. I think I'm just kind of, I'm lucky when it happens, and when it doesn't, you sort of, some days I just have to walk away and just go, right, I'm going to go do something else because it's just not happening today. Luckily, it comes more often than not. But I think you can certainly put yourself in that mindset. And sometimes there is something to be said for just sitting in that chair. like sit for, even if it's 2 hours, you don't write a word, you're sat in that chair. But at the same time, you shouldn't kind of berate yourself too much if that voice isn't talking to you, because you can't make it talk. I don't think I've not heard any tips yet. The first time I sat down to write it, it was going to be a screenplay, and this was probably about 2011. And it was so different from what it is now. It was kind of about a fantasist, almost like a Billy Liar kind of. I wanted to write about a guy who's obsessed with movies, and the pitch has always kind of been high fidelity but with film. I think originally it was kind of Billy Liar but with film. And it had all these like fantasy sequences where he'd be at work and like zombies had burst in, and you'd never kind of quite know what was reality and what wasn't. And that screenplay never really got off the ground. It always felt too high budget. It always felt a really tough pitch. And in the film industry, it's like so hard to get anything made, especially if you're a first timer, that you don't want to be going around trying to sell something uniquely personal. That's a bad idea. But in novels, you kind of, I think you can kind of be a lot more kind of not open and honest, because you should be doing that in screenplays as well, but you're kind of given a bit more freedom to kind of express yourself with a lot more room. So it just sort of, this story just seemed to fit the novel much better than the script.
How did you at all begin to tackle that? What was the very first thing that you did after you had this idea? You think, right, it can't be a screenplay. I'm going to have to get it down in 350 odd pages. Where did you start? What was the first thing that you began to do?
So there was a small idea with the original screenplay that I was going to show the breakdown of a relationship in one room. So you'd literally see a couple meeting in a bedroom at a house party. And then the next week you'd see them sort of on a first date. And then the next week you'd see them starting their relationship. And you'd see it all from this one perspective, almost like a bird's eye view of this room where everything was going down. And when I had that idea, I thought that could play throughout the novel. So it could literally be every other chapter could be this first night. And in the end, I totally did away with the just one room, because that would be so boring, and kind of set them on this odyssey instead. And then it was a case of what's the other half of the story? And that was going to be the breakdown of the after the breakdown of the relationship, the guy trying to figure out where it all went wrong. And then the two kind of sat so nicely next to each other with this first night where kind of young love and all this hope and possibility could kind of be born. And then kind of the reality of life and relationships and how they can be quite tricky. And the two things next to each other, and especially with Nick's character and how he wants everything to be perfect and he wants this kind of movie love, it just sort of worked perfectly as kind of juxtaposed against each other.
You said earlier on, character is the most important part for you, your starting point for you to tell a story. How do you get to know them then? Characters, you know, have to be the most believable, the most tangible and authentic part of any novel. How do you make sure yours are relatable, especially in a love story like yours? How did you make sure those were grounded and three-dimensional?
Well, with the first novel, with Love Unscripted, it's not biographical, but there was definitely some massive crossovers with my life. So I did used to work as a projectionist. I do have similar anxieties that Nick has in kind of sort of wanting things to kind of be a certain way and kind of struggling when they're not. So there was a lot within my own life that I could kind of work from. But it was also, there is a type when it comes to kind of romantics and I think pop culture obsessed. And that's a lot of my friends and a lot of the people that I kind of used to work with and come across now, where I think there's a sensibility in people who are kind of obsessed with music and movies and TV, where they are quite sensitive. And I'm not sure how much it kind of is because we're kind of given these stories that have beginning, middles and ends, and they're quite neat, and we kind of want our lives to reflect that. Or it's just kind of actually these things that we watch inform who we are, because a lot of the time they have morals. So there's this kind of within, I don't know what kind of subculture you'd call it, but kind of pop culture aficionados, there is a type of person. And so I could glean from all of the people I know and from myself the characteristics that would be recognizable, that people would be like, I know a guy like that, or I am like that. And hopefully there's kind of some lessons in the books for people like that, and sort of how to deal with people like that as well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We'll have more from Owen in just a sec. Very quickly, if you are enjoying the show, if you want to see us do more of these as often as you can, please do support us over at patreon.com/writersroutine. We've done almost 80 of these episodes now. And if any of the authors that we've chatted to, from people like Ian Rankin, Val McDermid, Tom McRae, Anthony Horowitz, Cecilia Ahern, if any of them have given you any tips and advice on how to make your stories better, please do help us out. And by the way, we've got a huge guest on the show in the next few weeks. I can't say too much because I've not actually recorded it yet. It's still in the pipeline. But I think the next time that we meet, I'll have been there. I'll have done the recording so I can let you know more. It's a massive author. Someone that sold almost 300 million copies of his books. And he's going to come on the show. He's going to tell you all about his writer's routine and chat to us about the way he tells his stories. And if you're excited for that and maybe you want to help me out and make me under less pressure than I feel right now, if you want me to perhaps buy the writer a coffee to say thanks for the time, I'd love for you to do that. You can do that by getting over to patreon.com/writersroutine.
Hey, this is Tom McRae, and I wrote the book and lyrics for Everybody's Talking About Jamie. And as someone who's written in every genre of writing that there is going, from Doctor Who to kids to musicals to thrillers and all the rest, my writing tip would be, if you want to write in a particular genre, read, watch, research everything outside that genre. So if you want to write a Western, read something about the history of Rome. If you want to write a space opera, read a Western. I think the more you explore the genre outside you want to write in, the better the ideas you then bring into that genre.
Let's get back into it then, talking to Owen Nichols, this week's guest, all about his debut novel, Love Unscripted. Now, in this half, we chat about how much he really thinks about the actual words on the actual pages. Coming from someone with a screenwriting background, I'm really interested to think about everything else that makes up a novel, which probably doesn't go into a script and a screenplay. We'll chat about that. Also, we talk about the pressure of a debut and figuring out what you need to do for that second book when you find yourself in a two-book deal. And we dive back into things. Thinking about the characters for Love Unscripted and why for Owen it was so important to straight away get them into some trouble.
So somebody once told me you've got to put as many obstacles as you can in the way of your characters. So especially with a romance, it's kind of, well, I'm reading this because I want to know if they get together, or I'm reading this so that I know if they stay together or not. And that can be a very, very short book. So you have to find ways that kind of stop people being together. And in the case of the first one, it's all about character. It's the things inherent within them that kind of F things up along the way. So that's where I'd always kind of start, is who are the characters? We sort of know where they're going to go, but what obstacles are going to get in their way? And then you kind of need to find enough of those to not make it repetitive, but to be truthful and kind of recognisable.
But you say that we're kind of figuring out where they're going to go towards the end. At what point was the ending made clear to you?
I can't remember specifically. I do remember when I got there, I was like, yes, that's exactly how I want it to end. Without being given too much away, there is a kind of an openness to the ending where you can sort of pick your own ending in a way.
Why is that?
I think because I don't like things being too neat in stories. So while it's got nothing to do with the film In Bruges, I love the ending of In Bruges.
Okay.
And there's even a line in the novel about how it has the perfect ending, because it's just kind of, I just remember when the credits, I remember watching it and I was like, please let the credits roll now. Please let the credits roll now. And they did. And I was like, yeah, that's brilliant. I don't like an ending that's kind of so, what the hell just happened? But I also don't like kind of a neat little bow on it. I think the audience should be given enough respect to kind of be able to take the story on.
So how much of that then was a conscious decision, as in when the ending did make itself clear to you, how much of it was in the natural way of this is quite open, which you'd have liked, or did you kind of have to go back to it and think, you know, this is maybe too clear cut, I need to kind of make it a bit more ambiguous?
No, it came to me before the writing of it, so I knew where I was going to get up to. It was going to get up to a point where the audience could run with it. So that was kind of, that was quite an easy decision to make. In fact, there was no point where I kind of thought, oh, maybe there's an alternative ending. This was like straight up the ending that I needed.
We've spoken about the relatability of your characters and why they are required to be incredibly believable. When you're writing a love story as well, love more than anything else is the thing that everyone has, hopefully, and clings on to and you know, has ideals about. How did you make sure that the actual relationship and the love in your story was as believable as possible and authentic?
I think authenticity, especially with love stories, because rom-coms have a very bad reputation, I think, and an unfair reputation as well. I think some of the best movies are rom-coms.
Tell us more.
I think, I put a lot of films into the rom-com genre that other people wouldn't. So I think WALL-E is a rom-com. Okay. I think Fight Club is a rom-com.
How is Fight Club rom-com?
Okay, right. So,
and it's hard to talk about because of the rules, but...
Yeah, yeah. So the instigation of everything that happens in Fight Club is Marla. He sees Marla. She spurs on everything that happens. He ends the film with Marla. Everything he does in the midsection is to get to her. And it's so funny when you see it, because the first time, I don't think I even thought Marla was that important. Mm. But she's the reason he invents Tyler. She's the reason that he does everything.
Does that necessitate it being a rom-com, though? Or is that just... that's a motivation of a character it's not a bit in a thriller kind of thing.
Yeah, but I know what you're saying, but I think if the main driver of the plot is a romantic relationship, which we can argue over kind of how romantic it is, and the story's funny, I kind of think that's a romantic comedy. So yeah, the same with Wall-E. But I think films, especially in the mid-2000s, things like the Katherine Heigl comedies, you know, 27 Dresses, things like that, people were lazy about rom-coms. They were just like, right, we just need another one to saturate the market. And nowadays, people are starting to kind of look for that authenticity and look for that honesty again. So things like The Big Sick, which was somebody talking about their personal, something that they went through, that's what people are kind of gravitating towards again. And I think now we can kind of reclaim the rom-com for what it should be. In terms of kind of plotting, obviously with screenplays, you're kind of often told three-act structure. There's the Blake Snyder beat sheet that kind of gets forced down your throat. And it's good to know all this stuff, if only to break the rules. It's kind of, you know that you've got to introduce the characters. You know that you've got to put them on a journey that takes them out of their comfort zone. You know that you've got to have some kind of circular kind of storytelling where they finish almost in the same place but changed. All of those things help massively. And I think when you read the book, it's quite clear that it's kind of got a film plot, I think, in like a linear kind of, like, even though it's all over the shop. So we flip from 2012 to 2008. Then we have these intermissions as well that kind of jump back to different parts of their relationship. The movement of the story, especially from a character's point of view, is we meet a guy, he's in a place, he needs to learn something, he hopefully does.
And what's the aim of the story then? Like, what's the point of it?
It's hard to say without giving kind of too much away. I wanted to sort of speak to people like me who kind of maybe are a bit obsessive over kind of pop culture and that kind of thing, and kind of get them to see that there are more important things in the world than kind of what the new Star Wars trailer does to them. You know, it's kind of, it's about the people close to you and kind of paying attention to kind of their needs and wants, and kind of, it is in many ways a kind of coming of age tale. And I think in any coming of age tale, you've kind of got to, even though he's 27, I think our generation kind of potentially has grown up a little bit later than they should have.
Well, I'm 27 and I would love to come of age. So,
Well, pick up a copy of Love Unscripted.
We spoke earlier about how you're a splurger in some forms while writing. How much do you think about the next word?
I'm not sure if this is good or bad, but I'm not really a kind of word by word person. I'm more of a kind of scene by scene. So, and something that I kind of work a little bit more on is kind of descriptions of stuff, because I can see it in my head. I just kind of, even with my novels, it's kind of quite a filmic visualization process. So I can see it, and sometimes I need to kind of stop and go, wait a second, the reader doesn't know where we are, and maybe you can give them a bit more kind of description of who they're seeing. So word by word, yeah, it goes back to the kind of the voice that just comes out of nowhere. It just tells me what the next word is, and I'm never clinical in, like, do these words go together? Sometimes I like a nice little bit of alliteration or something, and I can be probably a little over-enthusiastic with wordplay, but I'm never so pernickety that it's more about the feel of what's happening than it is the bit by bit, if that makes sense.
And you're moving, as we've said, you're moving into writing a second book. What have you learned from your debut? What have you learned from getting that down finally through the editing of it? How has that influenced the way you're writing the new one?
That's a really good question. I think I've learned mainly that it will get finished. Like that's kind of the thing with all writing, is that especially when you're kind of in the first half of it, or even when you're right in the middle section, you're just like, I'm never going to finish this. This is never going to be a thing. And when I wrote the first one, I had no idea that it would kind of, I'd be on podcasts and kind of doing book signings and stuff.
Literally everyone's like, on a podcast now.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
I wouldn't hold much store by this.
Yeah, that's true. But I'd never thought that it would kind of be in shops and be a thing that I could kind of talk about. So knowing that that's the end result, if you keep at it, that's kind of one of the most important things that I've learned. It's just do a bit every single day and you'll have something. And if that thing isn't successful, do it again. Just write another one and do it every day. And if that isn't successful, do it again.
Is there, you don't need to answer this, but is there a third book, as in are you locked into a third one?
No, there's a two-book deal. I've got quite a few kind of TV and film projects that I kind of want to get back to, but I'm there are ideas that I have for the third one, definitely.
Well, about the second one, so when you got into the two-book deal, had you any idea what the second book would be?
No, not at all, actually. I had some outlines, so I pitched, I think, four ideas, very, very rough ideas, to my agent and my editor, and they both kind of quickly came back and said, that one. So,
okay.
Yeah, I was more than happy with their decision in the end.
And generating those four ideas, was that through a state of, I need something else, I'm going to sit there and just crack through this, or was it slightly more organic?
It was more kind of, what do I want to write about? It's kind of, first time round, it was sort of quite cynically, I suppose, one eye on the commercial viability of it. I think with your first thing, obviously you should be as authentic as you possibly can, but you've also got to understand that nobody knows who you are, so you've got to make sure that you're writing something that people want to read. With the second, I suppose there's slightly more freedom in the fact that people will have hopefully read the first one, and they'll go in kind of knowing your style and knowing the kind of thing that you want to write about. So hopefully the next one I can be just a little bit kind of, I don't know, a little bit looser with, maybe.
And lastly, speaking about readers knowing your style, what would you like a reader to think of when they finish Love Unscripted? What do they want, and they see that you've got a new one out? What do you want them to think of? And Owen Nichols' book is going to be this.
I hope funny. I think that's kind of one of the major kind of selling points to both the agent and the publisher, was that it made them laugh. There are some fairly emotional moments as well. So a lot of the kind of reviews have been, you'll be laughing 1 minute, but kind of crying the next.
Crying the next.
Yep, that's always good to hear, that you've made somebody cry. Weird thing to say. But yeah, funny, heartwarming, and that they kind of like learn something as well. I know that sounds, again, a bit kind of delusions of grandeur, that, you know, what I could write would make people reassess their lives, but I hope they get something that they can take away from it, and it's not just a bit of fluff that they forget about, but there's like a little truth that maybe they haven't acknowledged before, that they go, oh yeah, okay.
And that is it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Owen Nichols for coming on the show, for telling us all about his debut novel, Love Unscripted. If you're a fan of pop culture movies, things like High Fidelity, all the Nick Hornby ones, I think you'll really enjoy the story. If you do want to get a copy and help out the show, follow the link that's in the podcast notes for this one. because it will send you to a link that helps you buy the book, and also it gives Writer's Routine a little kickback too. If you want to help the show as well, you can always do that by pledging to us over at patreon.com/writersroutine and by leaving a review for the show over on Apple Podcasts. That way, people who need the advice from our authors can find the advice from our authors. Now, next week on the show, maybe not next week actually, because I'm off on my holiday. October, by the way, gets a little bit scattergun, maybe a little bit of November too. So just bear with me. I'm going to try and bring you these as often as I can, but sometimes it might not be possible to do every Friday. I've got loads of interviews in the bank though, so don't worry about that. We are carrying on. It might not just be every Friday. I'll keep you across it though over on Twitter, so give us a follow. It's at Writers Pod there. Anyway, before I was derailed by admin, the next time that we chat, we'll be speaking to the author Ruth Hogan about her brand new story, The Keeper of Lost Things. That's next time on Writers Routine. I'll see you then. Bye.